help each of his people identify the things that they needed to do to make a real contribution to the department's overall success. As part of the contribution planning process, Pat asked his employees to prepare descriptions of their key responsibilities and activities, and to take a first shot at setting goals in each of their key performance areas. Pat then met one-on-one with each of his people. In the meetings, he discussed and formalized each employee's actual roles, goals, and value-added responsibilities for the upcoming performance period. There was great value in the time that Pat took to work closely with each of his people in this regard. The meetings clarified for everyone the expectations and standards they needed to meet, and they gave Pat a chance to describe what success would look like, both for the department and for all of the individuals involved. The result was that each of his people came away with a full understanding of what they needed to do to meet their new and more demanding departmental goals. I want to note here, these days, it's equally important that managers and their staffs determine the things that are not part of each person's job. That's right. Effective coaches work with their people to identify and eliminate time-wasting and non-value-added activities that can creep into any job over time. This helps everyone use their time, resources, and talents more effectively. In going through that process, Pat and his people identified a number of activities, practices, meetings, and reports that were no longer value-added or needed within Pat's department. By identifying these resource wasters, Pat put his people in a better position to focus on the truly important things. In the final piece of his performance planning process, Pat focused on the important issue of support. He asked each of his direct reports what they needed from him to be successful. More information? What process wasn't working? Pat was actually using the performance equation, which stands for performance is always a function of talent times motivation times support, to make sure that each of his people was equipped to succeed, as coaching touches all three parts of this critically important equation. Well, at the end of the performance planning session, Pat and his staff were more clearly focused on what they needed to do, both as a group and individually, in order to be successful. Pat had done what good coaches do, but the work of good coaching doesn't stop here. Once Pat and his direct reports agreed on performance expectations and the new performance period began, it was critically important for Pat to take the time to monitor and track the ongoing performance of each of his people. Pat spent time observing and monitoring his employees' activities as well as their output. And in doing so, he put himself in a perfect position to provide his employees with ongoing feedback so as to recognize, reinforce, realign, and reward desired behaviors, and to help keep each employee on track. And he made it a point of managing by walking around in order to stay connected to his people and observe their interaction with customers and other stakeholders. It was a sharp choice that helped Pat form a closer bond and a stronger working relationship with everyone. I want to break away from Pat's story here to give you a better understanding of what good coaching looks like at the individual employee level. According to our research, a truly effective coach needs to become proficient at tailor-making a feedback and support strategy for each specific employee. The way to do that is to understand each employee's level of talent and motivation. Based on the interaction of these two important factors, we've identified four different kinds of employees who each require a different kind of coaching in order to reach their full potential. The first kind of employee is the kind that every boss is grateful for, the dream employee. These employees are highly skilled and highly motivated, and one of the operation's best resources for getting results. These folks are typically self-starting, self-motivated, and they do more than is expected, and they like new challenges. If you're working with dream employees, you need to think about your coaching role as that of being a nurturer. That is to say, as a leader, you need to identify new and challenging job assignments for each dream employee, provide them with regular doses of praise and recognition, offer additional responsibility, and empower them with additional decision-making authority. You need to look for ways to reward their great performance and to keep them motivated and feeling valued. In addition, you need to look for development and learning opportunities to help your dream employees grow and develop. Both your dream employees and your operation will benefit hugely if you give them special assignments to develop new skills and provide on-the-job training experiences that will help them grow. You can even give them coaching opportunities of their own as they can help develop other employees. Employees in this category, they know what they're doing and they already work hard. So you need to do everything in your power to let them know that they are truly needed, respected and appreciated in order to keep them motivated, while at the same time helping them stretch and continue to develop as professionals. Next is the up-and-coming employee. Employees of this kind are highly motivated and willing to work hard, but they may lack some of the skills and talents they need. Up-and-coming employees can be new hires, transfers, or maybe contract employees. So you may need to become more mindful and active in your role of with them as a trainer and a coach in working with them. To be effective in coaching them, you need to be both a teacher and a trainer. You need to spend sufficient time observing their performance to identify specific skill gaps that they might have. And then you need to create a meaningful training plan to help them acquire the talent that they need for success. A good coach of up-and-coming employees will provide them with solid instructions, additional on-the-job training, and maybe more formal training. You also may want to give them the opportunity to work with a talented coworker who can serve as a role model to them. The goal is to do whatever it takes to help these employees become more proficient in the skills that they need for better performance as quickly as possible. Your primary challenge in working with up-and-coming employees will be taking the time to smooth off any rough edges that they may have in terms of their skills. Fortunately, the fact that these employees are already motivated means that they're almost always willing and hungry to learn. You'll find that the time you spend with them will be a great investment towards improving the operation performance that you're looking for. The next category, underachieving employees, will put your coaching skills to the test. Employees in this category typically have the skills, expertise, and all of the talent that they need to do good work, but they're low on motivation, and that deficit tends to get in the way of producing better results. So in order to coach these employees, you need to be a motivator. It's not uncommon to find underachieving employees who do the bare minimum in getting by, and they lack any commitment to their jobs or to your organization. They often have negative attitudes and a generally poor work ethic. These employees are sometimes called cruise control people because they seem only partly present and they fail to use their talents to the fullest. The encouraging thing about underachieving employees is the fact that they have the potential to achieve. They can be strong performers on any given day. They just don't perform at consistent high levels. You need to try to find out what is sapping their motivation and fire up their willingness to work. You also need to make it clear the consequences of failing to do so. You'll find it helpful when working with this category of employees to take even greater care in establishing performance goals and standards, so as to create a greater sense of employee performance ownership. You'll also want to track their performance more closely to create a greater sense of accountability. Where you see them engaging in desired behavior, be sure to reinforce it, but be willing to use constructive criticism, reprimands, or even negative consequences to move their performance in the right direction. If you find yourself under pressure to achieve better results in a short period of time, as Pat was, you'll want to devote special attention to employees in this category immediately. You can ill afford to allow lax work by this type of individual to drag down the team's overall performance. Oh, and by the way, be aware that other employees in your operation will be watching carefully to see how you handle these employees as their own workloads are being ratcheted up. Your credibility will be on the line, so you need to be encouraging, fair, but very firm in your approach. The fourth category of employees is the toughest. It's your change or go employees. These people, unfortunately, are the least likely to be of help as you try to improve your organization's performance. They not only lack motivation, but they don't have the ability or the requisite skills to do their jobs either. These individuals might have been bad hires in the first place, or perhaps they used to be effective employees, but they were placed in the wrong positions and then lost all motivation to try. Whatever the case, they've become hangers-on, or as some like to call them, the workplace walking dead. They take up space and do little or nothing to contribute. To get employees like this to perform, you need to be a miracle worker. But one way or another, you need to step up and take control of what is a highly undesirable situation. You need to either change the employee by helping them become more productive, or you need to change the employee by replacing them. You don't really have any other options, because the longer change or go employees stay around, the more problems they cause. They have a negative impact on their coworkers, and they can also destroy and damage customer relationships. Addressing both the ability and the motivation of employees like this simultaneously in a reasonable time frame is a tall order at best, and it can be emotionally draining to say the very least. When coaching change or go employees, it's always prudent to consult with your HR department for their advice and counsel. Coaching an employee of this kind requires reviewing the employee's employment record, tracking the employee's performance record to date, and ensuring that the employee has the proper tools and support to be successful. Then, it's imperative to clearly define in writing all needed performance changes that the employee must make in order for employment to continue, and to work directly with the employee to create an improvement or turnaround plan that the employee owns. That's right. The employee must take ownership of what they must do to retain their job. You need to give the employee every opportunity to succeed while making it clear that a failure to do so means termination. Once this plan is in place, be sure to monitor the employee's performance on a daily basis, providing ongoing feedback and documenting the employee's actual contribution. This ongoing performance tracking is critical to create accountability and to spot progress or the lack thereof. It's important to keep in mind that change or go employees are capable of turnarounds when they're properly coached and when they're confronted with the harsh consequences of non-performance and failure to improve. But when clearly established and communicated performance standards are not being met, and the employee is not responding to attempts to help him or her improve, your role as coach needs to shift to that of disciplinarian and documenter. This means that you need to formally prepare for the employee's demotion or termination. While it's always painful to see someone lose his or her job, if people in your operation are underperforming, you have a moral and social responsibility to address the issue straight up. And make sure that your HR people are your partners in this action. So how did Pat do in coaching his own people? Well, I advised him to have short monthly meetings with each of them to review how they were doing and what they were focusing on. I also recommend that he discuss each employee's performance with the employee regularly and solicit each person's input on what he or she needed to do to improve. To Pat's credit, These one-on-one meetings became part of his coaching modus operandi with great success. The collective performance of his department improved, and Pat's team met the company's goals. Now stop and think about what Pat did to improve performance in his department. First, he came to the realization of the importance of coaching and feedback in developing his people's talents. Next, he assessed his own strengths and weaknesses and took steps to acquire the skills and support he needed to be successful in his role as coach. Then he clearly defined winning for his team, but equally as important, he used a performance planning process to define what each person needed to do for the team to be successful. Finally, Pat developed a tailor-made coaching strategy for each of his employees to provide them with the feedback, motivation, developmental experiences, and accountability to maximize their individual performance. Now, I don't know if I've done Pat justice, but I can tell you that in 12 months, he became a better leader and a great coach. And it all happened simply because he needed to get better results, and he was willing to take real action to do so. In the end, Pat was very coachable himself, and that made everything else possible. At the opening of this lecture, I told you that I love the practice of coaching. And the reason I do is because I would not be where I am today without having had a number of great coaches in my life. And I don't just mean coaches in the workplace. The coaches who have made a real difference for me include my parents, Clint and Rita, a couple of bosses early in my career, my pastor from church, and my great wife, Cindy, who is the best coach I know. You see, all of these people have helped me set direction. They've kept me motivated, and they've given me the feedback and development opportunities I needed to become the best that I could be. Oh, and one last reason I'm totally committed to effective coaching is the fact that, yes, I did drop the pass in the big college game. I was embarrassed. I was humiliated for failing to make that catch. And I've experienced firsthand the damaging effect that a bad coach can have on the confidence and performance of a player. My coach's comment made me focus on the possibility of failure rather than on the possibility of success. As an adult, I've often wondered what would have happened if the coach had simply said, "After you catch that ball, try to score," instead of planting a negative seed in my mind about dropping it. But the experience made me want to become a better coach for others. So in the long run, it helped me in a remarkable way after all. Remember that as a coach, you can have a powerful and positive effect on the performance of the people around you if you're committed to their success. Listen, learn, and lead well.
This lecture is titled Understanding Power Relationships.
Have you ever heard people in your organization say these kinds of things? "I'm sorry, but I don't know if I have the authority to make that decision." Or, "It seems like the power has really gone to his head." Or maybe, "It isn't what you know around here, it's who you know." Or how about, "My boss holds all the cards and he won't make a decision." Do any of these statements ring a bell? If not, count your blessings. But if they do, know that you've got lots of company. These kinds of proclamations speak to the issues of workplace power, authority, and influence. And those issues shape the formal, informal, and political landscape of virtually every organization on the planet. To be honest with you, most of us have had little, if any, formal training or education on these important and, in some cases, taboo topics. So we're expected to learn about the complexities of organizational power, authority, and influence through our individual experiences and trial and error learning, which can sometimes be quite painful. If you study organizational behavior for a living like I do, You can see some pretty common and reoccurring mistakes that people make with regard to power, authority, and influence that I want to share with you. Mistake number one, not taking the time to fully understand the formal authority and power that is attached to your current position at work. Mistake number two, failing to take proactive steps to increase your personal influence at your place of employment. And mistake number three, failing to effectively influence and manage your working relationship with your boss. So in today's lecture, we're going to talk about these issues so you can avoid these kinds of mistakes that can have a potent and even dramatic impact on your career success. To start, we're going to talk about power and where it comes from at work. Power has lots of definitions, but a person or group has power when they possess the capacity to exert influence or control over the actions of others to bring about desired outcomes. A person or group has power when they have the ability to impact or control the behavior of others through any number of different means. And they typically possess something that someone else desires. And when we think about power, we frequently think about presidents and kings and CEOs and military leaders and the like. But the truth of the matter is that we all possess some degree of power that is attached to our current position. Influence, on the other hand, is power in action. Influence is the effect that a person or work group's actions can have on actual attitudes, beliefs, and actions of others. While power is the capacity to impact others, influence can be thought of as the extent to which power is actually being put to use to impact others. Influence means that a person or group is actually causing others to behave differently. So while the president of my organization may have a great deal of power, his or her ability to influence my daily behavior and actions might actually be quite limited. Power and influence are critical to any study of organizational behavior. And most people are absolutely fascinated by this topic. It seems like it's just human nature. Just think about the all-time biggest box office movie hits we watch. They almost always tell their tales based on how someone is using or abusing power. Whether it's Vito Corleone in The Godfather, trying to subjugate rival gangsters, or the characters in Lord of the Rings wrestling over a magical kingdom, or an evil corporation in the blockbuster movie Avatar, trying to take over and control a planet for its resources. In each case, we find the struggle for power thought-provoking and worthy of our time and attention. Now let's direct some of that attention to a better understanding of power at work. Okay, here's a question for you. Where does your power and influence come from in the workplace? Well, here are some important insights. In 1959, researchers John French and Bertrand Raven developed a classification of the bases of power which are quite instructive. And they made a case that certain factors can be used to create influence and dependency. They identified five basic types of power: legitimate, reward, coercive, expert, and referent. Legitimate power is the formal authority granted to a person by their organization because of the position they hold. So our bosses have legitimate authority over us to assign work, review our performance, grant us decision-making power, and enforce many company policies because of their position and our organization's chain of command. And there is legitimate power attached to the position that you hold as well. Now, reward power is a person's ability to provide others with rewards, incentives, and inducements to influence their behavior. When a leader can control budgets, pay raises, bonuses, and promotional opportunities, it can have a powerful impact on the behavior of others when properly applied. Coercive power, on the other hand, is the opposite of reward power. When a person possesses coercive power in the workplace, they can influence others by the use of sanctions, punishment, reprimands, or removing benefits and or resources. Coercive power is typically based on fear and the realization that if I am not compliant, there will be negative consequences. These first three sources of power are collectively known as position power because they're clearly tied to the position that a person holds in an enterprise. Okay, so let's apply that information to avoid the first common mistake that I described earlier, not understanding the formal power of your current position. Have you taken the time to assess how much legitimate power and authority is attached to your current position? Have you determined the things you control, the decisions you can make, and the actions you can take of your own accord? And if you're in a leadership position, are you making full use of the rewards and the resources you possess that can influence the behavior of others in positive ways? Have you taken stock of the potential sanctions that you have at your disposal to impact, influence, and shape the behavior of the people reporting to you when behavior or performance are not where they need to be? Don't make the mistake of not knowing the extent of your position, power, and authority. Your answers to these questions can have a very powerful impact on your ability to get things done and achieve success within your organization. Whether it's relationship building, communicating, motivating, building a team, coaching, or decision making, it's critically important to understand the power attached to your position that, when properly applied, can make these practices work. Now, the last two bases of power fall under the category of personal power. Personal power is the power that is tied back to what you know and who you really are as a person. Expert power results from a person possessing a specialized knowledge or a skill that is prized and needed by others. If you're an expert, people are willing to follow your lead because of your knowledge, the knowledge you possess, your ability to solve problems, and your ability to make sound decisions. And because of your expertise, you have an increased ability to influence the people around you, even if you might not have a great deal of formal position power. Just think of the influence that an IT professional has when your computer system crashes. All of us are quick to listen to, defer to, and even take orders from an IT specialist because we are in need of the information that they possess. And in some cases, we desperately need their expertise. As you've probably heard, knowledge is power. But to be more specific, knowledge is expert power. Now, the final base of power is known as referent power, a term that refers to the potential influence that a person can have over others through strength of personality. Referent power is all about our ability to connect with people and forge strong and effective working relationships with them. It's also known as charismatic power, and it's based on an individual's attractiveness and the personal characteristics and personality that they possess rather than a formal title or position that he or she might hold. When we respect somebody, we look up to her and we trust her, and we're much more likely to follow her lead and be willing to emulate her behaviors. If you don't believe me, stop and think of all the actors and sports figures who represent various products and causes that we see day in and day out. Organizations know that the right spokesperson can use referent power to have a real impact on their potential customers and donors. Now consider how understanding our personal power can help us avoid the second common workplace mistake I described. Are you taking proactive steps to develop your personal power in your organization? When you add up your position power and your personal power, that will determine the amount of influence that you have in your organization. And people with influence are in a better position to get things done and be more successful with their careers. I meet a lot of frustrated leaders and professionals who feel as if they have very limited voice and the ability to impact what's going on in their organization. they often feel underappreciated and disengaged. And they are frustrated about their careers, that they're not where they thought they would be at this point of their working lives. So these people frequently ask me, what are the things that I can do to increase my power and influence in my organization? Well, here are some very specific things that you can do to increase both your position and personal power. First, it bears repeating that it's really important to know and understand the position power that you possess in your current job. It's important to know what you have to work with and the boundaries that you must operate within. And know that if you don't use your position power appropriately, there's a good chance that you just might lose some of it. Be very careful not to make your position power the sole basis for getting work done, because people will soon lose respect for someone who has no basis for power other than his or her title. Similarly, the use of reward and coercive power can make people compliant, but it doesn't necessarily translate into people being committed to what you're trying to accomplish. That's why it's an imperative to develop your professional and technical expertise. People acquire power when they possess needed skills and information. Becoming an expert in an area that is critical to your organization's success is a surefire way to increase your organizational influence. And your influence will be even greater if you teach this expertise to others. So is there anything stopping you from developing your own professional and technical capabilities? It also never hurts to become an expert on your own organization. Know your mission, your values, divisions, products and services, customer base, and the like. Knowing these important things and being in a position to use this information when needed makes you a great resource to the people around you. You can always use your expertise to help others solve problems and make better decisions that will benefit your organization and your team. There's lots of research that makes it very clear that a person who can help his organization solve important problems and improve performance will become more influential within their enterprise. Now, here's a really valuable and important practice for gaining influence, and you already know what I'm about to say is true. It's really smart to develop great 360-degree working relationships, build strong teams, and create strong social networks, both within your organization and across your industry. Have you ever noticed that successful and influential people in your organization are typically very well connected across the enterprise? The obvious question is, which came first? Did their success lead to their network of great working relationships, or did their great people network lead to their success? This is something to think about that we can all improve upon. Creating and building on referent power base is something that most people can do if they're willing to make it a real priority and they develop the emotional intelligence to do so. Simple and yet powerful people practices, like making it a priority to remember people's names, is really important. And the same can be said of being friendly and asking newcomers and visitors if you might be of assistance. Projecting a positive attitude and demonstrating common courtesy to the people around you are all very effective tools for building your influence, while you're also creating a better place to work and be known as a person who's easy to work with. An important aspect of referent power that can increase your influence is being the consummate professional. And there are many practices that can help you build that reputation. Here's a quick exercise. Think of the most professional person that you've had contact with on a regular basis. What made you think of him or her? What is it that makes that person so very professional? Review the best practices of other great professionals in your discipline as well and see what you can learn. Professionalism has different meanings across different professions, but here are several practices that make the cut across most professions. Knowing how to dress appropriately for both your organization and your clients is more important than most people realize. So dress for success. Knowing how to write effective reports and emails that are concise, grammatically sound, and do not have typos is key. Typos can send a pretty strong negative message about your abilities, whether you want to admit it or not. Keeping your workspace clean and organized can send a powerful message to the people around you about your professionalism. And this is, again, especially important in dealing with your internal and external customers. Knowing how to make a great presentation, how to run an effective meeting, how to use and share data, and how to explain complex things to people outside of your discipline are all influence builders. Above all, cultivate a reputation as a person who gets desired results. Whether it's in your daily work, a special assignment, or some portion of a high-profile project, do your best to clarify the outcomes your organization needs and engage in the key actions that are tied to success. Properly allocate your time and track your performance and deliver. The important point here is this. When a person doesn't effectively use his position power and lacks expertise and problem-solving skills, his influence is going nowhere fast. And when a person is hard to work with and isolates herself from other people or chooses not to demonstrate the key practices of being a professional as prescribed by her discipline or organization, he or she just might be finding themselves being marginalized. So understanding your position power and your personal power and developing your organizational influence is critically important to your success. Perhaps nowhere, though, is this more important than in your working relationship with your boss. So let's talk about how to avoid the third common workplace mistake I mentioned, failing to effectively influence and manage that relationship. While preparing for this lecture, I had two very interesting conversations with two different friends of mine in the same week. Both of my friends had had real issues with their bosses, and they were struggling. And what was particularly interesting was that their bosses were complete opposites. One boss was strong, domineering, always moving fast, and managed with a lot of authority and control. The other was very laid back and hands off. He didn't provide much direction, offered little or no feedback, let people pretty much do whatever they wanted, and he avoided conflicts at all costs. After listening to my friends describe their different situations, it was obvious to me that their working relationships with their boss were not working. So I asked each of them this simple question: what are you going to do about this situation? And they both had the same response. You mean leave? To which I answered, no. What are you going to try and do to better manage your working relationship with your boss? In both cases, they were surprised by my question. They both had assumed that their only option was to transfer or leave their organization to escape. In fact, most people believe that our boss is our boss, and have never considered what they need to do to better manage them. So let's talk about the specific things that you can do to manage your boss. And this is the same advice I offer to my friends to help them upwardly manage their relationship with their bosses. Start by assessing the quality of your current working relationship with your boss. Our research shows that people are generally quick to assess working relationships with peers and subordinates, but people often fail to see the value in assessing their working relationship with their boss. Taking the time to understand what is working well and what needs work is an important first step towards managing your boss. Here are some important questions to guide your assessment. What does your boss do that helps your productivity? What does your boss do that hurts your productivity? What do you need from your boss that you're not getting? What specific things are needed to improve the overall quality of your working relationship? Answering these questions will give you a starting point for developing your improvement plan to better influence your boss. Now, work hard to get to know and understand your boss. You and your boss are linked together whether you like it or not. So it's really important to pay attention to how he or she operates. What motivates your boss? What are your boss's likes and dislikes? How emotionally intelligent is your boss? And does your boss have any personality quirks or idiosyncrasies that you need to take into account in working with him or her? Possessing this information should put you in a better position to use your own emotional intelligence to find more effective ways to communicate and interact with them. There is no substitute for finding out what makes your boss tick. Next, try to put yourself in your boss's shoes. Find out your boss's performance goals and what your organization needs and expects from your boss. It's important to understand the challenges and pressures your boss faces on the job, and these things can potentially impact you and your fellow coworkers. When you know your boss has overly aggressive goals to meet, too much on his or her plate, resource shortages, unrealistic timelines, or maybe even a bad boss to work with themselves, it can make you much more empathetic and puts you in a better position to offer help. Remember, it's important for you and your boss to be on the same page and to pursue success together. Help your boss clarify exactly what your job entails and what results are needed from you to help your boss be successful. When bosses are extremely busy, it's not uncommon to find drift between the boss's expectations and the employee's performance expectations, as well as a different view on what priorities need to be. While performance planning sessions are important, it's a great practice to regularly create a list of all the things you're currently working on and the results you're pursuing for your boss to review. Then, schedule a meeting with your boss to make sure that you are properly aligned. You want to make sure that you are successful in your job by the standards that your boss is using, because if you are, your success will continue to contribute greatly to your boss's success. And make sure your boss clearly understands that linkage. Here's another tip. Make it a practice to under-promise and over-deliver. Most bosses appreciate when their people exceed expectations, whether it's meeting the deadline for an important project, solving a customer problem, or hitting an important goal. Your long-term career success is contingent on developing a track record of consistently delivering desired results. So when you deliver what your boss expects on an ongoing basis, or maybe even better yet, more than your boss expects, it establishes your credibility as someone your boss can depend on. And there's lots of research that makes it perfectly clear that once someone depends on us, our influence with them increases quickly. It's so important to learn how to communicate with your boss as well and keep your boss informed. Most bosses have a preferred style of communication. Some like to do all the talking, others listen, and others prefer reading. So what does your boss prefer? Most bosses also have a preferred channel for communicating. It might be via team meetings or one-on-one discussions, emails, managing by walking around, and even the good old-fashioned telephone. The important point is that you understand how to proactively interact with your boss in a fashion that your boss prefers, at times that increase the likelihood of effective interactions. And knowing the best and worst times to interact with your boss can be a real game changer. Remember, it's important to demonstrate initiative to keep your boss informed on the status of projects, important performance metrics, and other information that puts them in a better position to make decisions. A natural byproduct will be an increase in two-way communication between you and your boss, which is almost always a good thing. And while there may be exceptions, it's generally not a bad thing to ask your boss, hey, how are things going for you? Or how was your weekend? or share a good book you've read or a good movie that you've recently seen. Fostering an appropriate personal side of a working relationship with your boss can actually make it easier to talk about work-related things. Now, here's a really important practice for all of us. Take the initiative to make alignment sessions with your boss a regular occurrence, both to help you stay on track and to keep your boss coaching. And here's another practice that can go a long way to help your working relationship with your boss. Never identify a problem or bring a complaint to your boss without having a potential solution in hand that you have thought through. Most of our bosses have a fair number of problems and issues on their plate on any given day. So don't be surprised if you get less than a warm reception when you go to your boss with yet another problem or difficulty. If there's an issue that you do need to bring to your boss's attention, make sure that you properly frame it up and get all the facts, and make it easy for your boss to understand what the issue is all about on the front end. Then take the time to offer up your ideas and your potential solutions to the difficulty. For complex problems, it really helps if you've taken the time to write up your ideas in a clear, concise document. We all take things more seriously when they're put in writing. The document tells your boss that whatever the issue is, it's serious, and that you have concern enough to have invested the time to jumpstart the problem-solving process. Bosses like people that help them get their work done, so your initiative will probably be appreciated. If you develop a more solid working relationship with your boss, it will help your boss help you when you need his or her assistance. The better your working relationship is with your boss, the stronger your track record. And the more your boss trusts you, the easier it will be to ask for your boss's help, input, resources, and guidance. So if you've established yourself as a trustworthy employee who has both the competency and character, you should be in a better position to ask your boss for assistance when you need it. Finally, it's important to always show respect for your boss. Don't engage in gossip, backbiting, or making your boss look bad behind his or her back. Lots of people at work lead dual lives and have multiple personalities when it comes to their bosses. To the boss's face, they're upbeat, compliant, obedient, obliging, accommodating, helpful, and even openly respectful. Yet behind the boss's back, they just might be the exact opposite. They might make fun of their boss or mock him or her or demonstrate open contempt and resentment. While I understand why people engage in this practice, here are a couple of warnings. First, these things never happen in a vacuum. Other people are watching and listening. When word of your bad-mannered behavior gets back to your boss, it can spell career disaster for the backstabber. Second, it sets a terrible example for others, and it can have a real demoralizing effect on them. And finally, it also causes other people to wonder what you might say about them when they're not around. It really reflects poorly on the character of the person doing the bashing. So here's some simple advice in this regard. If you don't have something good to say about your boss, it's probably best not to say anything, as tough as that might be. In spite of all the advice I've just shared, it's really important to remember that as a subordinate, there's really only so much you can do to change your boss. If your boss puts you in a place where coming to work is more stressful and unproductive than it need be, then it just might be time to consider leaving. And if your boss is prone to extreme uncontrollable mood swings, has a destructive personality, or is engaged in unscrupulous activity, it's time to go now. But for most of us, taking proactive steps to help our boss help us is simply a good thing to do. And taking the time to understand our relationships in the workplace and to cultivate our power and influence in those relationships is not only smart, it's absolutely essential to our career success. So listen, learn, and lead well.
This lecture is titled Handling Workplace Conflict.
Whether we like it or not, conflict is an inevitable and sometimes inescapable part of organizational life. And that isn't always a bad thing. If you're in a leadership position, or if you aspire to a leadership role, a great deal of your success will depend on how well you respond to, handle, and manage conflict among the people you work with. So I'd like to help equip you with some basic knowledge to do just that. I recently interviewed a CEO who I thought did a great job of describing the challenges and benefits of workplace conflict. She said, "I spend quite a bit of my time working through and resolving disagreements and even conflicts among the members of my leadership team. They're very strong-willed and passionate people who need me to help them channel their energy, their goals, and opinions in positive ways." So I say that conflict can be constructive when it brings people together and causes them to be honest and truthful in discussing a real issue. But if left unchecked, conflict can become petty, personal, and pretty ugly. It's a skill I need as a leader and a skill I need my leaders to possess if we're going to be successful as a leadership team and organization. Do you see a lot of disagreement and conflicts at work? Does conflict get in the way of you doing your job and getting results? How do you handle conflict? Let's step back and consider what conflict really is and where it comes from. The word conflict dates back to the 15th century and comes from the Latin root conflictus, meaning to combat or strike, which immediately tells us that conflict and the potential for conflict is something to be taken very seriously. Conflict exists when there is a perceived incompatibility of interests between two or more individuals or groups. Or stated differently, conflict is the process that results when one person or group perceives that another person or group is attempting to frustrate or negatively affect their interests and actions. So the starting point for most conflict is opposition, incompatibility, disagreements, or a collision of interest that takes place between people or groups that may be interdependent but have different ideas, priorities, needs, interests, and values. These are the roots of conflict that are simply facts of life. People sometimes have opposing interests. It's how you handle that opposition that makes all the difference. In one of my recent surveys of American business leaders and other professionals, nearly 70% of respondents said that they believe that conflict in the workplace is on the rise. Now, why would that be the case? What factors might be producing a higher incidence of conflict on the job? The respondents to my survey provided some very interesting answers, and here's what they said. First, there's the pressure factor. As organizations experience greater competitive pressure, the respondents said that they are constantly being asked to change and to do more with less and to do everything faster. As jobs change, workloads increase, and the pace of people's personal lives accelerate, they have more pressure and stress. And with more pressure and stress, our communication and coping skills can easily break down, making us cranky, cantankerous, and crabby. All of this pressure, in turn, can make us harder to work with and more susceptible to workplace conflict. Then there's the complexity and change factor. As organizations grow in size, they increase in complexity. The respondents said it's becoming a greater challenge to have a shared vision and strategy that's understood by all, clearly defined roles and responsibilities, and high levels of teamwork and cooperation. As complexity increases, so does the likelihood of organizational politics. Organizational politics is a fertile breeding ground for workplace conflict. So the more complex an organization is, the greater the chance of conflict. Another major source of conflict is the competition factor. The respondent said as their organizations experience rising external competitive pressure, they're also experiencing an increase in internal competition. So when people are competing for scarce resources, like budget allocations, rewards and promotions, healthy competition can easily degenerate into open conflict. And then there's the leadership factor. As their organizations become more competitive and more complex, the respondents reported that there is a rising need for dynamic leaders to step up and constantly realign their leadership skills to meet the challenge. But many individuals are not practicing the fundamentals of leadership in their rapidly changing organizations. And the natural result is unnecessary and counterproductive conflict. And finally, there's the social factor. The respondents reported a greater range of workplace attitudes, values, and personalities that are increasing the likelihood of interpersonal conflict and tension at work. Society's changing, and it's inevitable that the workplace will change with it. If those changes produce tensions in society at large, they will undoubtedly appear in the workplace as well. So workplace conflicts are a naturally occurring phenomena. And given today's competitive work environment, it's not surprising that they're on the rise. But they still present a serious challenge for anyone who's trying to keep an organization operating at peak performance. So let's take a closer look at the nature of conflict, how actual workplace conflicts develop, and how they can be prevented, managed, and resolved. There are two primary types of conflict: substantive or task-based conflict and emotional or affective conflict. Substantive or task-based conflict exists when individuals and groups have differences of opinion. They may differ over such issues as facts, goals, strategies, plans, policies, processes, roles, resource allocation, decision-making, or many other things. A conflict is substantive when the issues driving the disagreement are tangible, material, and reasonably concrete. Selecting a new software vendor or developing the budget for a project are both substantive issues. Others include task-based activities, such as setting new goals for an upcoming year, establishing the timetable for rolling out a new product, or re-engineering a broken process. Some substantive conflict just might be inevitable at times. People have different opinions about issues such as how the business should run or how the business should function. And these types of conflict can be beneficial if people are focused on sharing their ideas and opinions so that they can get at both the truth and the best solution to a problem or disagreement. But here's the key. These differences of opinion can escalate into arguments, verbal fencing matches, and even open range wars when they're not properly managed. And when this happens, unchecked conflict over issues of substance can damage and even destroy working relationships, teamwork, and careers. Handling substantive conflict is all the more challenging because there's also another kind of conflict to deal with, and that is emotional or affective conflict. Emotional or affective conflict exists when there's tension between people because of personality differences or in a breakdown in their interpersonal relationship. This type of conflict arises when people don't like each other, when they have personalities that clash, or when people have irreconcilable workplace differences that become very personal. Emotional or affective conflict is as inevitable as is substantive conflict, but it's much more volatile. So you need to take special care in identifying it and taking actions to minimize it. To make matters even more complicated, conflict within any organization can break out at several different levels. Intergroup conflict exists when there is a struggle taking place between groups, teams, or departments, or even different operations within the same organization. Sales versus operations. Marketing having problems with IT. Or the accounting department struggling its relationship with, well, everyone. Just kidding. Intergroup conflict exists when there's a conflict within a group or a team. And it's not uncommon to see a work group or team fractured and split up into subgroups. These splits can take place because of differences and disagreements around a wide variety of both substantive and emotional issues. Finally, interpersonal conflict exists when two people are caught up in a skirmish or a scuffle over work, or even over a non-work-related issue. Interpersonal conflict is often at the root of other forms of conflict, although that's not always the case. It's really important to remember that conflict can be substantive, emotional, or both at all three of these levels, with each level presenting its own set of challenges. Let me describe for you some specific examples that I've experienced that will illustrate the types of conflict that we've just discussed and how they can arise in the workplace. At a senior leader planning retreat, there's a serious discussion around setting sales goals for the upcoming year. In the past, senior leaders simply came up with a percentage increase that was based on the previous year's sales. The CEO, though, is now asking that data from a detailed market and industry analysis be used in the goal-setting process. The senior members of the sales team are resisting the change, and they feel as if they're being ganged up on. And this has led to some very heated exchanges during the meeting. This is an example of a substantive issue and disagreement that has the potential to spill over into a substantive conflict if not properly managed by the CEO and the meeting facilitator. And the potential for this situation to degenerate into an emotional conflict is ever present. Now let's look at a different real life situation. Two employees work in the same department as customer service representatives. They were both hired within several months of each other, and they're very competent. But after several months on the job, they seem to be stepping on each other's toes and sniping at each other. And they're constantly bickering and talking past each other. The tension between them is spilling over into the break room and into their relationship with coworkers. And the situation has become a real distraction to getting work done in the department. On the surface, this looks like an emotional conflict from the get-go. But as it turned out, no one ever clarified each of their roles and authority for decision-making. So they were constantly butting heads in handling customer issues. The root cause of the problem was a substantive conflict that was never addressed. This substantive conflict degenerated into a very emotional and personality-driven clash. And here's one more. Two frontline supervisors in a large manufacturing facility have just been ordered to go to the plant manager's office. They work on the same shift where one has been a fixture and a strong performer for the past 12 years, and the other was just hired in the past 6 months. Department performance has been slipping. The supervisors were still hitting their production numbers, but their departments were not working well together, and the pressure was building. This translated into tension in the break room, inappropriate graffiti and practical jokes, and absolute communication breakdowns. The plant manager seats the two supervisors in chairs opposite his desk, and he asked the veteran to explain what the heck is going on. And out of nowhere, the senior supervisor says, "I don't like this college boy. I think he talks down to me. He thinks he's better than me. He dresses like a pretty boy, and I think he tries to make me look bad." The younger supervisor's mouth dropped open in disbelief to hear this declaration leveled at him. And as it turned out, this potentially troublesome situation was purely an emotional conflict from the start. The veteran supervisor, who had worked his way up through the ranks, didn't like the college boy who was hired into the same position right out of school. The veteran was working to undermine him at every turn. And this potentially volatile situation would have only gotten worse if the plant manager hadn't intervened and gotten to the root of the problem. What these examples make clear is that workplace conflict can easily become dangerously destructive in the absence of intervention. Without effective leadership, virtually any substantive issue in an organization can turn into a conflict. When the substantive conflict is left unchecked and unresolved, it can quickly become an emotional conflict. And once a conflict becomes emotional, it becomes more unpredictable and infinitely more difficult to fix. We've also seen that sometimes conflicts are emotional in nature from the start, for any number of reasons. People in the workplace sometimes just don't click. And the longer these emotional conflicts simmer, the tougher they will be to work through and sort out. So what steps can you take to avoid unnecessary workplace conflict and better handle it when it does occur? Well, over the years, I've developed some practices that you can use to avoid some of the unpredictable and negative outcomes associated with conflict. First, it's imperative to create individual role clarity to ensure that everyone knows and understands their job responsibilities, their authority, and who they report to in the organizational structure. This clarity can go a long way to help prevent conflicts over these very important issues, and can also have a powerful impact on motivation and teamwork.